I think most of you know who I am, but I'll say who I am for the sake of the tape. I'm Jerry Folk from the Shalom Center in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I'm also working part-time for the American Lutheran Church as the Director of Peace and Justice Ministries. The subject that we're talking about today is a continuation of what we talked about on Monday, and I want to remind you of what the overall title of these two subjects was, and then what the subtitle for each one of them will be. We talked about political models for the future, and on Monday we discussed the question of moving beyond the nation state, talking about the need for some kind of global structures to deal with problems that cannot be dealt with by individual nation states. And today we're talking about the question of violence under the title Beyond Violence. I think these two issues are closely related to one another. The nation state over its history has relied ultimately on the use of violence to defend itself and to solve any conflicts which it has with other nation states if they can't be solved by other means. But also, the nation state isn't the only structure that utilizes violence in attempting to govern and attempting to rule and bring about order. So these two questions are closely connected with one another. And I mentioned last time that both of them are sort of brought to an extreme by the existence in our world today of weapons capable of destroying the whole world. Violence has escalated to the point where a technology of violence is available that would effectively end civilization, if not human life, on Earth. Now, I suspect that when we consider social reality, the societies of the world, and so forth, we would all agree that it is impossible to govern the world without some use of coercion or some use of force. To attempt to do so would invite chaos beyond what is tolerable for any of us. But I think on the basis of that conclusion, which we all probably share, we've too quickly decided that, therefore, lethal violence is an acceptable means of governing and of holding things together. There's a difference between the use of coercion and or force on the one hand and the use of violence, particularly physical and lethal violence. Coercion or force is a much broader category, of which violence is only a subcategory. We've often identified the two and thought that since we can't govern human affairs without the use of force or coercion, therefore we can't govern them without the use of violence. Now, I think that there are many different examples of the presence of violence in our societies and in our world. The most extreme and massive form of violence is, of course, the violence of war. War is an institutional and, from the perspective of human societies, legitimized use of lethal violence on a massive scale. But war is not the only example of the use of violence in the affairs of human beings. We have capital punishment. We have other forms that are more subtle, other forms of violence. Very often, violence, including the violence of war, breaks out as a result of genuine and unavoidable conflicts of interest. Sometimes, conflicts of interest involving significant issues of justice, or right, or truth, which must be resolved. But I think that nevertheless, the question of violence, the reality of violence, poses serious moral and religious questions for sensitive human beings, for Christians. It is not a form of dealing with conflict which is very easily compatible, very easily made compatible with Christian faith. So the moral question which we face as Christians, and also which other human beings of goodwill face, is the question about alternatives to violence, given the fact that we can't govern human society without some manner of force or coercion, given the fact that we cannot create a world without conflict, a world without conflict of interest. Is there some way of dealing with this conflict, of expressing this conflict, of fighting, if you will, that doesn't rely on violence, doesn't rely on war? Are there other ways, alternatives, ways of fighting that would enable us to depend less or to depend not at all on violence in our pursuit of truth and justice? A man by the name of Gene Sharp, whom I think is a very significant scholar in our world today, says that there is. He calls this alternative a political equivalent to war. And he's written many books on this subject, but I think the most important one is this book, Social Power and Political Freedom. Lowell referred to it a few sessions back. He teaches at Harvard. And Lowell spent some time with him when he was on his leave this past year. This book is a collection of essays that Gene Sharp has written throughout his lifetime, some of which are much more important than others. But two that are extremely significant, I think, is the essay titled by the same name as the book itself, Social Power and Political Freedom, and also an essay titled Political Equivalent to War. This is a sort of adaptation of the title of an essay written by William James in the early part of this century. William James was a great American philosopher, and he wrote an essay titled Moral Equivalent to War. In that essay, James recognized that war not only brings out the worst in people, but often it brings out the best. Sort of a willingness to sacrifice for a cause, willingness to sacrifice for the fellow soldier next to you. People sacrifice their lives even in time of war and forget about themselves. War brings out this capacity in human beings to forget themselves in their devotion to a cause and to another purpose. And William James said, that's a good thing, but it must be possible to invent a moral equivalent to war, some kind of a cause, some kind of a fight, which would bring out those qualities in human beings, but not in the context of the kind of carnage that goes on in war. And that was the thing that Gene Sharp took off on when he wrote this thing, Political Equivalent to War. He said there must be, it must be possible to invent an institution which would function in society in the same way that war functioned. He pointed out that the sociologists have said you can't eliminate a social institution until you are able to develop another institution which takes the place of that institution in terms of its function for society. And Gene Sharp believes that there is an institution or a process, a means of fighting, which could replace war as a way of dealing with human conflicts on the personal but also on the political level. The level of interest groups within a society, classes fighting for rights within a society, or nations fighting against one another. In his he calls this alternative to war, nonviolent direct action. And nonviolent direct action, he believes, can accomplish the same thing for a society that war accomplishes, only without the destruction of war, if it is practiced on a massive scale. He, in his great sort of masterwork called Politics of Nonviolent Action, which is a three-volume work, he sketches the history of nonviolent action from Roman times into the present. And he points out in that book that nonviolence, a practice of nonviolence to accomplish certain ends and goals in society, is not new to our time. Already in the Roman Republic, nonviolent actions were practiced with the purpose of accomplishing certain political goals. And he goes all through history describing these different examples of nonviolent political action, including a number of instances where nonviolent resistance was used against Hitler in Germany and also in the occupied territories, the Nazi-occupied territories. One of the most interesting and exciting essays in the book is a description of what you might call the other side of the Holocaust. As you know, 6 million Jews were destroyed in one of the most vicious genocidal programs in history. But Gene Sharp points out, not as a way of minimizing the Holocaust, but as a way of telling the other side of the history, that an equal number of Jews were saved, and they were all saved because of nonviolent resistance offered by Italians and Danes and Dutch and Belgians and Bulgarians and all kinds of people who refused to cooperate with Hitler's genocidal Jewish policy. He also describes an action in which Gentile women, German women, who were married to Jews, undertook a demonstration in front of the Reichstag and Hitler's palace in Berlin, demanding the release of their husbands who were under arrest. And they succeeded in getting their husbands released and were able to leave with the country with their husbands. The most well-known case of nonviolent resistance under Hitler is, of course, the Norwegian resistance to Hitler's policy. He wanted to establish a youth program in Norway on the model of the German youth, Nazi youth in Germany. And the Norwegian educational system absolutely refused to cooperate. It practically collapsed. Thousands of Norwegian teachers were sent to concentration camps and arrested. Some of them died, never were heard from again. The church also resisted. Bishop Burggraf, who was the head of the Norwegian church, was put under house arrest and kept there for years. But the result was that Hitler had to completely abandon his plans to establish a Nazi youth group in Norway like he had established in Germany. In other words, in Sharp's view, nonviolent direct action can be effective in accomplishing political goals under all different kinds of regimes. Now, Sharp contends that in order to understand nonviolent direct action and how it works, we have to think about the nature of political power and how political power works. He says that the common understanding views the ruler or the ruling class as kind of like a granite mountain. It just stands there. It has power within itself. But Sharp contends, and he refers to a scholar who's researched this, whose name I couldn't find in the essay, and whom I've forgotten now, to an alternative view of political power. In this alternative view, the ruler or the ruling class is really no more powerful than anyone else in the society. His power is derived from outside himself, or its power from outside itself. The sources of this power are in the society over which it rules. These sources of the ruling class's power can be identified, they can be located, and they can be cut off, according to this theory. The sources include things like the ruler's, the society's acceptance of the ruler's right to rule, and also the ruler's economic power, his access to manpower and to military resources, the police, the courts, and other institutions within the society, by means of which the ruling class makes its power felt. According to Sharp, all of these sources of power are dependent upon the cooperation, submission, and obedience of the subjects, of those who are ruled. When this obedience is refused or this submission is not offered, then the ruler's power is weakened and even removed. Sharp maintains that if the people are able to continue their resistance even under pressure of torture, of imprisonment, and of death, then the end of a regime, no matter how totalitarian or repressive it is in sight. I think we can think of Poland, for example. And we can see there the power that is involved in people resistance of this sort. And that story, that history is not yet over. But there are other examples of this. Now, as I said, Sharp maintains that this kind of way of fighting is nothing new to our time, but he also believes that in the work of Mahatma Gandhi, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, who lived from 1869 to 1948, a breakthrough was made in the area of nonviolent direct action. Gandhi devoted his whole life to what he called his experiments with truth. When he wrote his autobiography, he called it The Story of My Life, My Experiments with Truth. So he felt that his life, in fact, was this experimentation with truth. And through these experiments, I think he discovered the profoundly revolutionary power of nonviolent direct action and its potential to affect political and social change. A long time ago, I compared Gandhi to Einstein with my students, and I thought I was really smart to make that discovery, and then I discovered just recently that that James Douglas, in his little book, Lightning East to West, was saying the same things that I had said, so I wasn't so original after all. He pointed out that when it comes to social energy and political science, Gandhi is what Einstein is in the field of physical energy. Einstein made a discovery, the theory of relativity, which enabled us to release the power of the atom in our world and generate enormous quantities of physical energy. I believe that Gandhi similarly discovered a way of political action which can release equally powerful doses of social energy, and which in fact is far more significant for the human future than the discovery which Gandhi made, because it has much greater creative potential to transform and humanize human societies. Gandhi, of course, didn't create this out of nothing. He was greatly inspired by Jesus Christ and by Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, by Jesus' life, and particularly by the cross. According to Fisher, who was one of the biographies of Gandhi, and I recommend that book, by the way, Louis Fisher's biography of Gandhi called The Life of Mahatma Gandhi, when Gandhi went to the Vatican, he was so captured by the crucifix that he spent many hours in front of the crucifix just weeping. And I think if you read Gandhi's teachings, he understood the power of suffering. The power of suffering to bring about change, because nonviolent direct action is based upon the power of suffering. The people are able to suffer for the sake of their cause and to persist in their suffering, if necessary, to the point of death. And that's what the theology of the cross is about, that through suffering in love, power can be released, political and social change of profound dimensions can be effected. Now, many say that the reason Gandhi was able to succeed in India as well as much as he did was because of the civility of the British regime that ruled India. But in fact, the British regime was not as civil as many people think. Did you know, for example, that when the British conquered India, there was a very well-developed textile industry, and very fine cloth was made. The Indians, in fact, exported their cloth throughout the region. But the British, for economic reasons, wanted to turn India into a cotton-producing society which would consume British-produced cotton goods. And so they passed a law that weaving was forbidden, and the penalty if you were caught weaving was to have the tips of your fingers cut off so that you couldn't weave anymore. Also, in the early years of Gandhi's struggle in India, there was at least one large-scale massacre, and other people were killed. So while the British rule cannot be compared, obviously, to Hitler's Nazism, it was not so polite always or so harmless. But I also pointed out, and the reason I did so was to sort of counter this argument, that nonviolent action has also been tried under the most brutal regimes, including the regime of Hitler in Germany, and has both succeeded and failed. In some cases it succeeded, in other cases it failed, but sometimes war succeeds and sometimes war fails, depending on which side you look at it from. And it is also important to note that Gandhi worked for 20 years in South Africa before he ever went to India to work. All that he discovered and all that he did in India was practiced, first of all, in South Africa and accomplished considerable success. Gandhi, in fact, was able to get the government to meet and grant all of his demands in South Africa. Sharp points out that the successes of nonviolent action occurred even though these nonviolent actions, including Gandhi's, took place spontaneously and did not have any long history of experience, even less a collection of writings which explained the way in which nonviolent violence functioned or gave the theory of nonviolent direct action. There was none of that. In contrast to the fact, Sharp points out, that the science of war has been studied by humankind for 4,000 years or more, and there are whole libraries of works written on military science. Not only that, but people are trained in the art of military science, trained in how to fight. One of Sharp's major points is that if nonviolence can accomplish as much as it has under those circumstances, that is, as simply spontaneous actions, which do not rest upon a very well-developed theory or practice, then surely if we were to study nonviolence theoretically and to train people in the art of practicing nonviolence, as we have done in warfare, the power of this way of fighting could be greatly enhanced. And to a large extent, it could replace war as a means of resolving human difficulties and as a means of fighting for justice and for truth and for peace on Earth. He likes to talk not about disarmament, but about transarmament. And by transarmament, he means gradually changing from a reliance upon lethal violence as a means of ordering and governing human affairs to a greater and greater dependence upon nonviolent direct action. He points out, he calls this civilian-based national defense, as opposed to military-based national defense. And he proposes academies and various other kinds of efforts to codify and study and analyze the theory and the workings of nonviolent action. He calls also for programs to train whole populations in the art of nonviolent resistance of an aggressor, whether that aggressor be a group within the country that seeks to oppress and tyrannize over the population, or an outside aggressor that seeks to move in and occupy the country and make it serve the interest of groups outside the country. I suggest that if you want to know more about this whole subject of nonviolent action and how it functions, then you read Louis Fisher's book, The Life of Mahatma Gandhi, or you read at least the two essays which I recommended in this book, A Political Equivalent to War and Social Power and Political Freedom, or you read Gandhi's autobiography, or maybe some of the secondary literature on this subject that has been written, such as Joan Bondran's book called Conquest of Violence. I believe that in addition to the necessity for the human race to move beyond the nation state to some kind of global peacekeeping structures, it is also necessary for us to experiment with alternatives to violence in the quest to resolve human conflicts. And I believe that Gandhi points the way. I believe that Gandhi, in this respect, is the most significant figure that has arisen. Pope Paul VI, I was really flabbergasted to see that in his World Day of Peace message in 1976, Pope Paul VI said, "Has not a small, frail man, namely Gandhi, taught us the way?" So I think that we Christians who believe in the importance of struggling for what we believe is right, who believe in the importance of fighting for what we believe in, namely justice and truth and peace, need to, of all people, be eager to discover alternative ways of fighting that are more consistent with the teaching of Jesus Christ and his life. Well, this concludes the first half of what I want to do, and the second half is what was announced for today, namely a talking about possible action opportunities for peacekeepers in the congregation and in the community. But I want to pause here to give you an opportunity to ask questions about what I've said or raise objections. I don't know whether this is new for you or whether you all are aware of these, but it's really exciting. It's really exciting to get involved in this and to see the newness of what is being talked about here by Sharp and what was being practiced by Gandhi. Yeah?
Is the success of nonviolent direct action dependent upon the people in power having a conscience?
Did you come in late?
Yes.
Yeah, because I talked about the fact that that's fine. No, I'm not trying to put you down or anything. I just wondered if I actually had said that or hadn't said it, or and also if you're like I'm, you don't always hear everything that's said. But I think that it's that at least the costs of nonviolent direct action are higher under certain social systems than under other social systems. I'm not convinced that it will work only under optimum conditions. I pointed out, for example, that the British regime in India was not as benign as it is often made out to be, that in fact there were massacres. People were just mowed down by gunfire and so forth in these campaigns. Many people lost their lives in Gandhi's campaigns, and Gandhi spent years in jail, years. Also, I pointed out that nonviolent action has been tried and was successful under Hitler's regime in Germany. In Germany itself, also in Denmark, in Bulgaria, in Italy, in Holland, in Norway, in all the occupied powers. So I would say almost more than violent resistance, it's more costly under some than it is under others. Gandhi had no illusions that no blood would be shed in a nonviolent resistance campaign. He said, let it be our blood and not our enemies. And he said, if you aren't prepared to shed your blood, then you're not prepared to be a satyagraha. That's one thing I forgot to say. You know, what Gandhi was doing was so new that he didn't know what to call it. He was influenced by Henry David Thoreau, whose essay on civil disobedience he read while he was in his first prison term in South Africa. He was also influenced by Tolstoy. In fact, he corresponded with Tolstoy. There, in the biography that Fisher wrote, there's a reproduction of letters that were exchanged between Gandhi and Tolstoy. At the very end of Tolstoy's life and the very beginning of Gandhi's work in South Africa, he was also influenced by the English political economist John Ruskin. But he went beyond all of those. He very quickly became dissatisfied with Thoreau's term, civil disobedience, because only a very small part of what Gandhi did was based upon civil disobedience. And he also became very unhappy with the term passive resistance, because he felt that what he was doing was not passive at all. It was very active. So he founded this newspaper in South Africa. He founded at least three newspapers in his life. One was called Young India. That was the first newspaper that he founded in India. Another, the last newspaper that he founded was called Harijan. You know, Gandhi took up the cause of the untouchables in India, and he said if he were convinced that untouchability was an integral part of Hinduism, he would renounce Hinduism immediately. And he gave his a great deal of his energies to the abolition of untouchability in India, and he renamed the untouchables Harijan, which means children of God. And then he founded a newspaper which he called Harijan. And in any case, in his first newspaper, Indian Opinion, which was the one he founded in South Africa, he couldn't figure out what to call what was happening. So he announced a contest and asked people to suggest a name for this thing. And a name was suggested, which Gandhi modified. He came up with the name Satyagraha, or Satyagraha, which means soul force or truth force. Satya is the Indian word for truth, and agraha is the word for force, the power of truth, the force of truth. That was a positive idea. He also talked about it as ahimsa, which means nonviolence. But actually, when you read Gandhi and read about Gandhi, you come to discover that ahimsa, more than nonviolence, is really almost the equivalent of agape, because it is not simply not doing any harm to your neighbor, but it is trying to do your neighbor good and trying to resist those forces in society which do your neighbor harm, which is in fact more what agape means than what nonviolence means. So I would say that a better translation of ahimsa than nonviolence is agape. Now I kind of lost the track of what I was saying, but I do think that it would be naive to feel that nonviolence is an easy way of getting what you want. Gandhi said it's a much more difficult way, because you're not relying on instruments of violence to protect yourself. He said there were three levels of courage, the worst. Three levels, three ways of responding to injustice. The worst way was resignation. The worst way was to, if you're black and coming out of the civil rights struggle, to shuffle your feet and wear your handkerchief. That's the worst way. The next best way is to fight violently for justice. But a superior way, Gandhi insisted, is to fight nonviolently. But you cannot be guaranteed that you won't have to sacrifice your life. For one, actually, nonviolent resistance wouldn't be a moral equivalent to war if it didn't entail the possibility of having to give up your life. Any other questions?
Would rather capitulate than be violent?
Yes, but I feel that he does not see those as the only alternatives. He sees, again, those three possibilities which Gandhi referred to: capitulation, resignation, failure to resist evil, would be the lowest on the ladder. The next highest would be to fight violently against what you believe is evil. But the higher and the third alternative is to fight in this way, in the way that I have described. It's not a way of capitulating, it's a way of fighting for what you believe in. But it's based upon a different understanding of power and a much higher level of moral and religious development. And I think we've tended to think only in terms of two alternatives. Either we give in, or we pick up our guns and our bombs and we fight. I think one of the problems in human history today is a failure of imagination. We think that we aren't good at imagining alternatives to what is. We think that the only alternatives available to us are those which we've always had, which we've always used. So nothing new emerges. Lowell, and then Lola. Yes, uh-huh.
And it is not capitulation.
Yeah, right.
Gandhi would be very strong in no capitulation of it at all.
Yes.
And
let me just, before you, I almost take back my answer to your question. I feel probably that the answers to Sharp would be, no, it's better to resist by violence than to capitulate. Even Gandhi said that for him, to resist injustice violently was better than to just cooperate with it. But he believed that there was a third alternative which was preferable to either of those two.
If nonviolent resistance worked against the Nazis, isn't there a possibility that it would work against the Russians as well? So whatever we think of the Russians, I mean, certainly there are things about Russian society that we would want to fight against, but maybe we could fight against it in a way that is more consistent with our Christian beliefs and values and our American beliefs. One of the problems when you resist evil is that you yourself become like the evil that you're resisting, because you adopt all the same means that they use. And then you become more and more like them. For Gandhi, that was part of the point. The means were as important as the ends. You had to resist evil by means which were not themselves evil. Because if you resisted evil with evil means, you became evil yourself. And the very thing which you were fighting for was more and more compromised. So there was less and less difference between you and the people that you were resisting. That's the primary answer that I would give. Also, whenever a question like that is asked, I think it's important for us to really examine the image which we have of the Russians. Now, I would want to be the last person to defend Russia or the Russians. But I'm not persuaded that everything which we've been taught about the Russians is absolutely true. I mean, actually, how much experience, first-hand experience or knowledge, do we have about Russia? So I think that maybe I shouldn't even introduce that, because it upsets people. At the same time, I can't resist raising that question.
I raised it.
Yeah, but I mean, I can't resist raising that idea. How much do we know? And how much of what we know is true and how much of it is false? I think it was Lowell who told me last night that ever since 1917, we have been given this image of the Russians, the Bolsheviks, of the communists. And then all of a sudden in 1941, we were fighting with them in a war in which we were allies. And there was a big political problem in the country. How do we make American people think differently about the Russians? And some man who was an expert at media and manipulation said, give me, what was it?
1 month.
1 month. And I'll change the image of the American people, the image of the Russians. among the American people. And I'll make them think of the Russians as champions of freedom and fighters, heroic freedom fighters. And that's exactly what happened. So now it isn't that I don't believe there's a lot of truth to what we have to say about the Russians. It isn't that I don't believe the Russians represent a threat to many of the things that I hold precious in the world. But I do not believe everything that everybody tells me about the Russians, or everything that the world tells me. And even if I did believe it, I would still say with Jesus Christ, I would still try to listen to Jesus Christ's words, love your enemies, do good to those who persecute you and abuse you. Or Luther's words, always say the most charitable things. You know, in his explanation of the Eighth Commandment. So we just dare not buy into this idea of demonizing the enemy, as though there was no human quality left in the Russians and the Russian leadership, which could be appealed to through nonviolent direct action. In fact, that's one of the principles of nonviolent direct action. There's no human being who is so perverse, so evil, that there isn't the possibility of touching him or her with some kind of a human act. So I think that we simply have to examine critically all that our the myths of our society and the things which we believe. They may be right, they may be wrong. Yeah, Lowell.
If I scare you a little, look at it. You've got these very helpful essays, the most recent ones especially, but there is a little book. You've got your big book, your little book. And this book also has the advantage of being here in the bookstore, which is the first volume of the Politics of Nonviolent Action, Power and Struggle. Very helpful, challenging book. I think I commend that book to you. Another thing, there's a little book called Making the Abolition of War a Realistic Goal. It's a pamphlet, book. This is available for $1, for $1, and the address is inside here. And I would commend that to your attention. There also are, if you want to use sometimes in your parish, I'm telling you, video series, Alternatives to Violence, the chart. And if you want to look at the other volumes, I have all three of volumes here in Politics and Nonviolent Action. You may like to take a look at that. And also, since you stressed so much and I think so well, the stuff on Gandhi, this book on Gandhi, Gandhi on Nonviolence, production by Thomas Merton. I can't resist reading, I quoted some of this to Jerry today, after having talked with you, Jerry, this afternoon. I just missed one sentence that really kind of hit me between the eyes. One has to speak out and stand up for one's conviction. Inaction at a time of conflagration is inexcusable. That is, when the flames of the building is burning, and you stand there and look at it, that, he says, is comparable to silence in the presence of evil and injustice. To me, that is a very significant analogy.
And that's, of course, why Gandhi did not like the phrase passive resistance as a description of what he thought he was doing. Lola, you had your hand up a moment ago.
Well, I jumped from concept to talking.
Yes, uh-huh.
And it seems to me that we are starting to see sort of a groundswell across the country. Now, in terms of the peace movement, which has been very quiet for a long time, now we're starting to see something really happen again. And I kind of wonder if anything is going to happen. It's not going to happen by nation, but it's going to happen
by people.
All over the world. Mm-hmm. And whether we be Christian, Buddhist, whatever we be, people saying through their governments, this can no longer be held.
Right.
And then governments will have to
hold. Right.
But if the governments are a small group of men.
Right.
Men,
yes. Well, President Eisenhower said, in his first term, I think, that one of these days, the people of the world are going to demand peace so loudly that their governments are going to have to get out of their way and give it to them. And I think that's what's starting to happen. We have to demand peace because the business of the government is really to defend us by military means. At least that's the way they define their agreements, their responsibility. Now, it's also important to know this groundswell that you're talking about is not confined to the Western world. Last year, 300,000 people demonstrated in Bucharest, Romania. 50,000 people demonstrated in East Germany. I have a friend who teaches German at Augustana College. He came back from Germany last year. He's a German. And he said that the big thing that's going on in East Germany now is that the young people are all wearing patches on their jackets on which are written these words from the prophet Isaiah, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And the government is very angry about this and saying, well, that might be true in the future, but right now we need both guns and plowshares. But the youth are saying to the East German government, well, how can you be opposed to this? We're just quoting the words on the statue which the Russians gave to the UN. If you look at the UN, which our great brother, the Russians, gave to the UN, if you go to the UN building, one of the most beautiful things there is a statue of a beautiful man beating a sword into a plowshare, and on the bottom of that statue is this quotation from the prophet Isaiah, and that was the gift of the Soviet Union to the United Nations. So that's a very clever thing that these East Germans are doing. They really, an expression of nonviolent direct action. What a man by the name of Gray, Politics of Nonviolence, called political jujitsu. You know, it's kind of the way in which the martial arts function is that when your enemy comes at you, you're not there. You don't push him back, but you're just not there, and he falls over. And so when the government comes at the East Germans, they say, well, it's not us, it's the Russians. We're just quoting this message from the Russian statue. You're going against the Russians by being opposed to the wearing of this patch. And in Moscow, I read last night that there was a demonstration of several hundred people walked through the streets of Moscow, mostly Scandinavians, but a few Americans, denouncing the nuclear policy of the East and of the West, and that the Russian authorities permitted that. In fact, the police protected, Yes. So it is a groundswell all over the whole world. In one respect, I think it's the species crying out to survive, crying out for survival. In another respect, I think it's the work of the Holy Spirit saying to people, this thing is the abomination set up in the sacred place, and people of the Spirit cannot tolerate it. You know, the risks involved in protesting this nuclear arms race are far less than the risks of going along with it and keeping it going in the same way that it has. Of course, there is no way to go that doesn't involve some risk. If we're looking for a way to travel that is without risk, we might as well forget it. But it's the question of which way is the more reasonable risk, and also for Christians, which way is the way more consistent with our Christian faith. There were some other questions. I think that politically speaking, I think the Russians are in a very precarious position. Just think of it. If you were a Russian, would you want to trade your situation for Russia? Here on the southeastern border is China, which is now making all these alliances with the United States and which is hostile. 1 billion people sitting on your border. You're involved in a border dispute with them. They have nuclear weapons, and they have 1 billion people. And then there's Iran, which is in all this tumult. This Islamic revolution and all the people in southern Russia are Islamic. It would be very easy for that revolution to contaminate, from the Russians' point of view, the Islamic peoples of southern Russia. And then you have on your western front all of these powers. France is a nuclear power. Britain is a nuclear power. Every nuclear weapon which the Russians do not possess is aimed at the Russians. So it is not a secure situation to be in, it doesn't seem to me. And then also, internally, your society is collapsing. If we have economic problems in this country, the Russians have far more. If the arms race is bankrupting us, which I think it is, it's bankrupting them even quicker. And there's all this unrest in Poland and in Czechoslovakia and in Hungary. So they're not. I mean, if we really look at things with our eyes open, I don't see how we can think that the Russians, economically, militarily, or any other way, are really in the driver's seat. We would, in order to imagine a similar situation, we'd have to think of China as a Russian satellite armed with nuclear, I mean Canada as a Russian satellite armed with nuclear weapons, Mexico as a Russian satellite, and we were so nervous even when there were a few missiles that were going to be put in Cuba. Well, that's the situation which Russia has to live with all the time. These enemy powers all along the borders. We're kind of going back and forth. But I think it's all interconnected. It's our way of viewing the world that we have to question and challenge. Yeah. Yeah. And the European powers are doing that as well. Right. Well, before we conclude, I want to do just a little bit of the second thing that I talked about. Now, where do you go? Well, I don't know, not many of you have been at other sessions that I've given because there's such a turnover in the community here. But if you have been concerned about the peace issue, the question is, what can I do about it? How, I mean, if it just stops here, it doesn't really mean much. But how can you contribute to the growth of this movement in our society? I would say, first of all, inform yourself more. Don't trust me. I mean, don't believe what I said just because I say it or because I quote this title or that author. Find out for yourselves. You're intelligent thinking people. Go to the sources yourself. Examine what I said. Think about it critically. Be open to it, but don't just accept it without critically thinking about it. Inform yourself. And I just brought a few books. Lowell referred to some. If you really want to know what the weapon systems are like, and I think that's essential if we're going to know, if we're going to be effective as peace agents, read this little book, The Counterforce Syndrome. It's available in the bookstore here at Holden. This was written by a man who was an aeronautical engineer and who worked 15 years for Lockheed Air Force, for Lockheed Corporation, designing all the missiles which we presently have. He became convinced that we're not interested in a deterrent strategy, but a counterforce strategy. That is, we're interested in developing weapons which will enable us to initiate a nuclear war and knock the Russians out before they can touch us. So he quit his job. Also, he quit it for reasons of Christian conscience. And he wrote this book and he lectures all over the country. But he knows this from the inside because he was one who designed these missiles. If we're going to be effective peace ministers, we have to inform ourselves about the weapons technology existing in the world. But we also should reflect on these things from a faith perspective. Another source of information on this subject with which you could keep yourself updated is the Defense Monitor, which is a piece that comes out several times a year from the Center for Defense Information. This was founded by retired admirals and generals from the military who believe that it's important for us to have a strong defense, but the strong defense does not mean stockpiling as many nuclear weapons as we can have or spending as much money as possible on arms. So they put out, I think, very well-researched information which balances the information that hysterical groups put out. And you can subscribe to the Defense Monitor by sending a contribution to the Center for Defense Information. I have a bibliography here that you can pick up afterward, and it has all these addresses and these groups in it. But then I think also, as Christians, who will probably be doing most of our work within the Christian community, we need to reflect deeply from the perspective of faith on this issue. Lowell has referred to this book several times, The Darkening Valley, by Dale Ackerman. It's a biblical study, really, of this issue. And there's another little one, which is Study of the Gospel of Mark, which is a study of the Gospel of Mark, written by Christopher Grannis and two other people. It's called The Risk of the Cross, 6 sessions on the Gospel of Mark, designed for adult or youth study groups. There are several other pieces that are equally useful. All of that is simply a first step, and yet it's a step that accompanies us all the way through. We have to continually inform ourselves and keep us updated. Because if people start pushing us, asking us questions that we don't know, we haven't done our homework, our credibility is decreased. But I think beyond that, then we have to try to work in our congregations, for example, to get this issue addressed, to get it debated. More and more congregations are having adult study groups on this subject. They're having youth groups to discuss this subject. Maybe the church council could study it as leaders in the church. You could have a resolution before your annual meeting or a presentation before your annual meeting. You could have Peace Sabbath in your parish, which is what many parishes have done. That is a Sunday when you devote the liturgy and the worship based on a biblical text to this subject. I think if you have a Peace Sabbath, it's usually good at the conclusion maybe of a month-long study of this issue. Then you bring it all together in the worship of the church, or a 6-week period of study, climaxed by a Peace Sabbath. And the bishops of the ALC and the church council of the ALC called upon all the congregations of the ALC to observe Pentecost Sunday's Peace Sabbath this year. So you have the support of the ALC institutionally for that. You could form a church and society committee in your congregation, which would be an advocacy group in the congregation for addressing this issue, but also other similar issues, justice issues, for example. Now, I think through these channels, you could raise the consciousness of people, begin to get people thinking about this. And unless this permeates the congregation, it's not going to affect political change in this society. But you get people to think about this, you could begin to inform people about this. When you do that, I think some of the most valuable resources are the film strips and movies and tapes listed on this bibliography. They're really high quality stuff. And there are many people who will watch a movie or look at a film strip that you can't get to read a book. Maybe the impact of that film strip or movie will stimulate them to read a book. But you can get people, more people, by using those kinds of resources. And they're inexpensive and they're more and more readily available.